Senate E-12 Finance Division will come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 20, 2013. Today we're going to continue discussion on the governor's proposed budget for education, E-12. And we do have on the agenda additional presentation from the department. I do not see them here yet. So we will go to public testimony, and as we had published, we encouraged persons to also submit anything that we could share online, and you'll see at the bottom of the agenda, handouts are being posted on the committee website for transparency for anyone that wants to refer to that. In order, we have names of persons that have signed up, and for anyone else wishing to testify, please tell us, we'll add you. If anyone here has a travel demand or a need to be somewhere else, let us know. We'll do our very best to accommodate. That's it. We'll continue, and we'll start with Grace Kelleher from the School Boards Association. Welcome back to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. It is wonderful to start my day out with you. As we reviewed the governor's education budget bill, I'm going to talk about the good because so often you hear about the bad first. Then the things we're somewhat concerned about, sort of in the right direction, but not enough. And then the things that really generated some serious thought and discussion in our office. And the things we like, we're going to start out with the compensatory revenue flexibility. And right now, there are some districts that get quite a bit of flexibility with their compensatory revenue dollars and have really been able to make some great headway going forward. The change in the bill goes from 5 to 15% for all school districts, and we think that's a valuable tool for local communities to meet their needs going forward. We also support the elimination of the pension subtraction, and this is one of those crazy formulas that you could never explain to anybody you know, and it's been in law too long and really isn't relevant to what pension costs are going on in Minnesota public schools today. So it's time to get rid of this antiquated formula and move forward. So we appreciate that language. We also support the English language learning change from 5 to 7 years. We think that flexibility really helps children from all over the world learn English going forward. And we have some quick learners who pick it up quickly, but we do have kids who maybe never even learned to sit in a chair, much less read English and speak English in a manner that can be testable and at a quality to graduate from high school. So we appreciate the flexibility with the additional years. Last but not least, probably the biggie on our list is the cross-subsidy for special education. That number is really getting to be sky high for all school districts around the state. And trying to buy that down and make some headway, though it's a difficult place because there's always more to go, the piece in the governor's bill really helps buy down that number. In the right direction, but the teacher evaluation dollars of $22 per pupil unit, we appreciate those dollars to really work on the phase-in of the teacher evaluation standards, but we are greatly concerned that number is not high enough by the least. And we have MSBA staff along with Education Minnesota staff who are meeting with the other body, fiscal analysts, to try to come up with a number we can share with you that really would cover the cost school districts from around the state are having. But I can just share with you, $22 isn't in the ballpark. So we appreciate the money, but I think we would really appreciate funding for teacher evaluation. The interesting thing, too, in the bill is charter schools would be able to receive that $22 per pupil unit, but in an interesting twist, charter schools don't have to meet the statutory requirements of teacher evaluation. So they receive the dollars, but don't have to meet the standard. We like the voluntary all-day, everyday K. It's a piece MSBA has been known for a long time. We really feel education works for kids, and certainly going all day in kindergarten helps. But when the department only funds 0.7 out of a program that full-time costs 1.115 per child, That's a problem. We're only getting 70% of our costs, and Senator Wigger is a former school board member. You understand that if you don't have the money to cover something like that, it comes out of your general education fund. And it's just sort of a, you know, go ahead and do it, but we're only going to give you three-fourths of the money you're going to need to accomplish that. The literacy aid, we have some questions about. That was actually a reading program where we were measuring how well we were doing on reading in third and fourth grade with the goal that all third graders across the state of Minnesota should learn how to read. When you adjust that formula and put in high school graduation, there's really some distance between those two events. Hard to tell if the new reading curriculum we're using and the new intensive focus on that is working when you add in sort of what I consider a random factor to what the goal of that program is. We are concerned about the extended time program. These are your after-school programs you provide for kids being rolled into the compensatory revenue program. That would not lay out those dollars in what we feel would be a fair and equitable way, and we'd like it to stay out of the compensatory revenue formula and is a separate categorical. We're concerned about the roll-in of the Safe Schools revenue. Senator Johnson had a Safe Schools bill up yesterday, and let me tell you, from the school districts around the state, we are very concerned about the safety of our students and our schools. And we've talked to Senator Doms about it also, and we think it needs to be separate so we continue to have community conversations and local districts can face that issue coming forward. The referendum resident student count for how you count referendum kids. Education is full of different ways of how we count kids for different things. The referendum adjustment where we're changing sort of midstream to a resident student count. Now, why this would impact school districts is because of open enrollment. If you accept a lot of children into your school district, that resident student count is going to look different. And because we have to go with referendums to the public, this number artificially changing concerns us. And transparency isn't a good enough reason to change it with our public to have it vote. Last but not least, we're really concerned about the 1% increase. It's not going to cut it. That's not going to help. We've got contracts in place that take more than 1% going forward. We don't know what our policies mandates are going to be this year going forward, and it's just we were so hopeful it was going to be so much more than that this year, and it was disheartening to see the one thing that every school district across the state gets evenly was only at $52 a kid. And last but not least, the change in weighting of kids. Pupils are weighted sort of funny in K-12, and the department talks about taking it back to a much more transparent method. Well, change without surplus is difficult, and what I'm afraid, because we have to go to the voters for our referendums, because we have to go to the voters and talk about our budgets, arbitrarily changing those numbers without good cause is going to have trust issues for districts around the state. And just for instance, I look at the general ed education aid. Presently, we receive $5,224 a child. Under the new way to count kids, that number is going to go to $5,700. For the average person in your community, they're going to think your school district got an additional $500. And that's not true. And I think that's really going to be something districts wrestle with going forward. Last but not least, as you think about money in this coming year and really education as at the heart of who we are as a state, we want you to keep an idea on outside forces. We are very concerned and hear from our national organization that sequestration is going to cut Minnesota education funding by 5 to 7%. If you do the math, that's much more than the 1% increase we're looking at. And that is going to go into effect in a week. Now, school districts, I think, won't see that till next year, but it's something you need to weigh going forward, that if we lose funds in that way, we go back to that general fund to augment those programs. We're watching the change in property tax. We're concerned about the cost of post-secondary, the PSEO program, and the concurrent enrollment program. As children take advantage of that more and more often, that is costing our districts money. So especially I'm thinking about the school to International Falls up north, who has a 20% of their junior and senior going to post-secondary education. And it's costing them almost $400,000 a year to support their kids in that way. We know it's the right way, Mr. Chairman, but that's a lot for a small district to have to bear. With that, I want to thank you for your time and attention. I greatly appreciate, as does my membership, your daily work on behalf of children. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher, and we'll have a chance to ask some questions now or comments from members. Also, I want to acknowledge Ms. Dietrich gave us some information on nutrition subsequent to the last hearing we had on that subject, so that's the source of that information at your place. Questions of Ms. Kelleher? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair Ms. Kelleher, you had talked about teacher eval money and not that the $22 would not cover the needs in order to put together a good program. But then you talked about charter schools don't have to meet the standards. So then what would they do with that money that would come to them?
Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I cannot speak on behalf of the charter schools, but certainly since they don't have to meet that standard, that would be additional money they would have to fund other programs. So it's just keep the standards and the money sort of going to the same place.
Ms. Kelleher, you said $22 pupil unit as proposed for evaluations was not in the ballpark. It's a mandate. What number would be in the ballpark?
Senator Wieger, I wanted to reiterate that we have our expert on evaluation here today at the Capitol along with his cohort in Education Minnesota, and they're going through the numbers with House fiscal staff to try to come up with a solid number. I will share that information with all you of what they agree to, but it sort of makes sense that between the two of us, we'll find a number that is reasonable and defendable going forward.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. We'll look forward to that information. Next, we have Scott Kroonquist from the Association of Metro School Districts, and he'll be followed by Jeff Solomon. Okay, Scott's not here yet, so we'll go to Jeff Solomon, who will then be followed by Sue Averholt. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Wieger and members of the committee. I am representing Minnesota Association of School Business Officials today. I am the past president of that organization.
Yeah. Mr. Solomon, for the tape, please state your name.
Jeff Solomon. Thank you. The Minnesota Association of School Business Officials represents 600 business managers throughout the state with expertise in school finance, public accounting, and operational support services such as food service, transportation, and fiscal management. We serve many customers in our daily work, with the most important customer being our students. Our members work with balancing budgets and the needs of students every day, both short and long term. And we understand that the state has similar challenges with their budget. Our organization promotes adoption of state legislation that will improve the efficiency and effectiveness of school districts' fiscal practices and operations. Our platform proposals are different from other organization platforms in that they all relate to school finance and operations, which is our expertise. None are intended to result in significant redistribution of resources among districts, and many are designed to make school districts more cost-effective and efficient with existing resources. This year, our platform was very supportive of the Commissioner's Working Group on School Funding. The existing funding system has been in place for decades, and our members deal with the complexities of the system on a daily basis. MASBO supports the work and the report of the working group, and we strongly recommend that legislature uses this report as a framework to guide discussions on ways to enhance and improve school finance and legislation. The working group recommendations address the need for structural change and phased-in implementation of fiscal responsibility. MASBO is supportive of the governor's proposal and believes that it's a good first step in walking into the recommendations of the commissioner's fiscal group, specifically in four areas: in investing in early learning, in eliminating and simplifying formulas and student calculations, in refocusing integration funding, and in reforming special education funding. We do believe that the governor's proposal of 1% increase to the basic funding formula will be helpful. However, it will not restore the loss of inflation to our basic funding formula over the last decade. I want to thank you for your time today, and I want you to know that MASBO offers our time as you work through the legislative session, and we'll be available to answer questions on any possible impact to school districts in the area of school finance and operations.
Thank you. Mr. Solomon, questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Solomon, quick question. You talked about supporting the governor's or the working group's recommendation. One of those pieces was re-implementing the general ed levy, supposedly to and repeal the business property tax. The governor instead has decided to give a $500 rebate. As a school business official, how do you see that playing out in your communities, the governor's proposal versus the working group, and where do you sit on that issue as an organization?
Chair Weaver and Senator Pratt. Again, we're supportive of the governor's proposal. We believe it's a good first step. The governor's proposal does not address any of the long-term issues of reform related to what the working group had proposed. And so the whole concept of reinstituting the general ed levy is really not initiated by the governor's proposal. The property tax rebate appears to, you know, would be a one-time rebate and really wouldn't address the needs from the school's perspective that the re-implementation of the general ed levy would.
Thank you. Senator Pratt, follow up.
Oh, yes, thank you. One other question. The governor's proposal didn't really address equity. Does MASBO have a position on equalization?
We do. We're supportive of Chairman Weger, Senator Pratt. We are supportive of equalization and would like to see that implemented as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Further questions of the testifier? Thank you for your resource.
Thank you very much.
Next, we'll hear from Scott Kroonquist, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to offer a few comments on the governor's proposal. And I'm going to try to be brief because I have a hunch that you're going to hear similar themes from a number of the testifiers today, and so I'll try not to be too repetitive. But I would like to add our AMSD's thanks to the governor for clearly making education a priority in his budget. I don't think there's any question that that was an area that he singled out for new investments in light of a still a significant state budget shortfall. So we're certainly appreciative of that. A couple of the key pieces that we're very happy to see in the governor's recommendation is the continuation of integration revenue, highly important. Most AMSD districts receive that, but I think, as you all know, districts really across the state, I think 139 school districts do receive integration funding. And if they're going to continue their efforts in providing integrated and equitable learning environments, that is just a vital funding stream. I will note, though, that you all know that the integration program sunset, but the state aid was included in the TALES, but the levy was not. And even under the governor's proposal, the levy would continue to sunset, which really would mean a 30% cut in that program going forward. So we are hopeful that the legislature will find a way to continue the full integration revenue program, aid and levy. We are also supportive of the continued expansion of full-day kindergarten. Our preference would be to see Senator Klassen's bill pass and fully implement full-day K, because quite frankly, if you go just halfway, it proves somewhat problematic. Not all districts are going to be able to make substantial expansions of full-day K under the governor's proposal, because you would have to offer it site-wide. And for some districts that are now offering a tuition-based program, it just wouldn't make the numbers would not work for them. So we would certainly like to see the full day K go all the way up to 1.0 for kindergarten students. The investment in special education is another area that we are highly supportive of. And I won't recite all the statistics, but you know that the special ed cross-subsidy is a huge issue for school districts. The cross-subsidy, I think, is over $600 per pupil now, district or statewide. And so anything we can do to try to make some progress there is going to be very helpful. Another point that we are very supportive of is the teacher evaluation revenue. The governor does propose that we provide $22 per pupil for those districts not in QCOMP. Frankly, that's probably not enough, but it's certainly a good start and will help those districts to implement that new mandate. And then I'll just highlight, members, a few concerns, and I think one was already referenced, but I think you are all aware that many of the increases that the governor proposes take effect in the second year of the biennium. And so, quite frankly, that first year is looking a little tough for school districts. I think you had the Anoka-Hennepin superintendent here a week or so ago telling you that for him, that's going to mean a $12 million shortfall in his school district, which could mean the layoff of up to 200 teachers. So obviously, he's not alone. It's not just an Anoka-Hennepin issue. Districts would be looking at a pretty tough budget environment in the first year under the level of funding that has been proposed. Probably the second item that I'm hearing the most about from our members is concern about rolling extended time into the compensatory program. For a number of districts that have really been utilizing that program and providing after-school or summer school programs, they are going to actually see a net loss of revenue under that proposal. And some have indicated they'd have a tough time even continuing to offer the programs that they're offering now, summer school programs or otherwise. So that is an area of concern. And then one other one, I think are aware the governor proposes to change the referendum pupil base from resident pupils to pupils served. And I just want to point out that one potential problem here is that you all know these referendums are not easy to pass. They're highly challenging. And we are a little worried that that could be even a little harder to pass when you start to have a situation where you're going to ask the local taxpayers to pay for students that don't live in that school district, that are coming into that school district. So that it's just something we've got on our radar. A few of our members, I think, are pretty concerned about that could create a tougher situation, a tougher climate to pass a referendum. And then the other one, this is not an item in the governor's budget, but an ongoing concern is the compensatory program in general, and that it does not provide sufficient revenue for school districts that really have a large number of students that qualify for free and reduced lunch but don't have high concentrations at a site. And so it's something that we've been interested in working on for years, is trying to maybe enhance that base funding for compensatory to address those kind of situations. And this was a real big issue in some of the larger geographic districts, the Anoka-Hennepins, the Elk Rivers, districts like that. And so it's something we would like to put on your radar, at least to think about as you move forward this session. So I'm going to stop there, Mr. Chairman and members, but we think the governor provided a great framework for you to work from, and I think he and the commissioner have made it clear that they view it as the first step and are willing to work with you and others, and so we're hoping that as we move forward that you can take a good framework presented by the governor and make it a little bit better. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kronquist. You started off by mentioning education as a priority in the governor's budget. Isn't it true, however, that the governor's budget proportionately is actually spending less on education than prior budgets? We go from spending about 42%, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, of the general fund budget on education to 38%. Am I correct in that? And maybe you can correct me on my numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I think you're correct on that. Yeah, I think, you know, education gets roughly 40-41% right now, and under the proposal would be slightly under that. And so obviously
I won't get you into hot water. I'm just looking.
We'd prefer to see that number move up a little bit.
Senator Peterson.
If I could, Mr. Chair, just make a comment. I mean, I think it's should be alarming to the members of the committee. You know, it's our largest spending obligation in the state is K-12 education. And what the governor has proposed is a massive tax increase of, if you don't include the rebate, which is debatable, you know, $3.85 billion tax increase, one of the largest, if not the largest in the state's history. And yet we're spending less proportionately on education. And you hear story after story of the testifiers coming up and saying that, you know, $52 a pupil isn't going to cut it. And so I think one of the responsibilities of this committee and hopefully you, Mr. Chair, is making sure that, you know, if we are going to raise this much revenue, which I think is totally irresponsible in this climate, but if we are going to, if we're set on doing that, which I don't think is possible either, given the fact that the B2B sales tax I don't think is going anywhere, that we're fighting to make sure that education is, in fact, as much of a priority as it has been in the past. And that would be what I would ask the members of this committee to consider, and you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator Peterson. And we share the goal of increased investment in education, and obviously those proposals are conversational starters. And if one doesn't support one way of increasing revenue, then show us another. So we'll have those opportunities to improve on the suggestions that have been made. Any additional questions of Mr. Kronquist? Mr. Kronquist, I don't think you mentioned the location equity factor. I believe that's still a part of the portfolio.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I mean, we are obviously very supportive of that. That's not something that's in the governor's budget. It was in the Education Finance Working Group recommendations as a part of that overall package. But as you and I think many of the members know, that's an issue we have been working on for quite some time, and it remains a high priority for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Next, Sue Eberholden from NAMI, Minnesota. Welcome back to our committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sue Eberholden, Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And for those of you who don't know us, we are a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As you are probably aware, children with mental illness have poor outcomes in our schools, high suspension rates, high dropout rates, high truancy rates. So we are very concerned, of course, about what's in the budget for these kids. Grace mentioned it earlier, but the Safe Schools revenue is really an important part of keeping children safe, keeping them moving forward in terms of being able to access education in our schools. We support Representative Johnson's bill, and so having some of that language in here and keeping the cost separate would be much appreciated. On the regional centers of excellence, we think this is a good idea, but we actually think it could go farther. There's two things that we think are missing. One is, and you should have received a report about a week or so ago from the Department of Education on the use of seclusion and restraints in our schools. One of the things that the working group said is that they would really like to have some expertise regionally to help schools reduce the use of seclusion and restraints, particularly on prone restraints. So I think adding to these regional centers some expertise on dealing with emergency mental health crises and dealing with the symptoms of mental illnesses in kids so that we're responding appropriately would actually be a good thing. On the new special education aid, we're obviously glad to see that there's increased funding for that. I will say that we're just a little nervous about the new funding formula, and I think you'll hear more from testifiers a little bit later. You know, we always funded it based on the teachers, because whether you have 3 kids or 10 kids, you needed to have a teacher on that particular area of expertise. And so moving it away from reimbursement for teachers but to a per pupil, we have not been privy to some of the numbers that have been run, and we'd like to look at that a little bit closer and make sure that we're not shortchanging anyone. We are glad to see that the reimbursement per pupil for children who have an emotional or behavioral disorder is not the lowest cost on the list, because, again, some of these children can be very high cost because they need to have they need to be in very, very small classrooms. The School Climate Council is another area we were very interested in because bullying does impact children. We do think that the work under positive behavior intervention and supports, which is an evidence-based practice, which really does set expectations, we've got very good outcomes from it, should be a part of that School Climate Council, because that really does help in terms of reducing bullying and helping with the social-emotional learning as well. We are glad to see some money in there addressing the paperwork issue. I have been around since 1982, and paperwork has been an issue since then, although we've always kind of pushed back to say, could you tell us exactly what the paperwork is on special ed? But we're glad to see that it's being mentioned there. One issue that is not addressed, although there is a bill that's been introduced to address it, is the care and treatment issue with children with disabilities, particularly children with mental illnesses who need to be in a day treatment program or a residential program, and how education fits with that. It has been a long simmering problem in special education. We've had a work group that has met for 3 years to try to come up with a solution and address it. It shouldn't be a burden to a school district. They really don't nor should have control about what type of treatment a child receives. We just need to make sure that they have education. And with that, I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear next from Connie Hayes, Superintendent of Intermediate School District 916. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I am Connie Hayes, Superintendent, Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District, and there are two provisions in the bill which I would like to provide testimony on behalf of the three intermediate districts. Together, the intermediate districts 287, 916, and 917 serve students from 31 member districts in the metropolitan area and many other non-member school districts. We employ nearly 1,800 staff, serving students at over 60 sites across the metropolitan area. Our core work with our members fall in the area of special education, vocational education, and area learning centers. The first provision is the teacher evaluation and development revenue. Although the intermediate school districts would be required to meet the provisions in the bill regarding teacher evaluation, the revenue supports being considered for the K-12 districts and charter schools are really not available to the intermediates. In the past, we've talked about how the intermediates do not have the capacity to generate very much in the QCOMP dollars. Most of our ADMs are counted in the resident districts. This bill does not offer aid to the intermediates to meet the provisions in the bill. We are in conversation with the Department of Ed about our concerns, and we appreciate their interest in learning how this part of the bill affects our unique set of services. So we continue to have that conversation and may have some suggestions in the future. The second provision is in regard to the proposed roll-in of the extended time into the formula. And there are three issues which I'd like you to understand. First of all, within the context of the current extended time revenue that is spent, it's important to distinguish between the larger portion that is spent on targeted services, which is those extended day and summer school
services that you heard about earlier, and distinguish that from the smaller portion of the revenue which goes towards credit recovery for high school students who are far behind in credits and at risk of not graduating. The second issue is that the ALC programs run by the intermediate school districts use this extended time dollars to fund our credit recovery evening and summer classes. These students are typically fully enrolled in their high school program and come to us in the evening and during the summer to catch up on their credits. For the intermediates in our ALCs, this is roughly about one-third of our revenue. So the roll-in of all the extended time into the formula does affect intermediate school districts significantly and different than regular high schools. Lastly, if these credit recovery services are no longer supported financially, we believe graduation rates will be negatively affected. The intermediate school districts continue to study the bill for potential impact on the unique set of services and programs that we provide to our member districts, and we appreciate, as I said earlier, the interest of the department to help us take a look at the bill and see how it is affecting us uniquely. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Superintendent Hayes. Questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hayes, one of the things we heard about the rolling in of the extended time was to increase the flexibility of school districts to use that funding. It sounds like that doesn't fit with intermediates, and I'm thinking specifically of programs like response to intervention. Would that, you're saying that the roll-in wouldn't help you be more flexible with the funding you receive?
Senator, members of the committee, we do support the general structure that the governor is proposing in his bill. What we find challenging during the legislative process is many of the bills that are put together do focus mainly on the K-12 environment. So we typically have to work with the bills and help staff understand how those formulas do fit us uniquely. So in reference to specifically the response to intervention, we would support our member districts having resources to continue to build that in their school districts. However, in regard to the roll-in of the extended time, we serve approximately 5,000 ALC students each year, and many of those students without that revenue for their credit recovery would not have an opportunity to make up those credits and then be at risk of graduating from their high schools. So as one of the unique services we offer in the metropolitan area, we do want legislation to take into consideration those services being available, having success with students, and to continue to support them going forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent Hayes. And our next testifier will be Brad Lindell from the Schools for Equity in Education. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brad Lindell. I'm the Executive Director of Schools for Equity in Education. And I always find this testimony to be the particularly challenging testimony of the legislative session. It's kind of like Christmas. You get a present, and the person giving you the present is very anxious for you to really love the present. And you open it up, and you say, yeah, it's kind of what I wanted. And you can't really say that. And so we really are appreciative of everything that the governor's done here. But I guess from our perspective in C, there are some what we believe are shortcomings in the approach from the buildup of what we had during the governor's working group, some of the things that were happening in that discussion that are absent from this proposal and are frankly are troubling to us. But we want to start with the good things because we do like the present. The general ed amount, there's a nod toward the general ed amount. It's not a hearty handshake, but it is a nod, and it says $52. But I think, as Mr. Kroonquist and others have said, going forward, when we look at, we've done some analysis that's on the C website, when you think that since 1991 that the general ed amount is about $2,000 lower than it should be for the money we've lost to inflation, $52, while appreciated, certainly doesn't put a big dent into that deficiency. In special education, we're very, very appreciative there. Again, we're $70 million below what was in the working group report, but the $125 million that goes to special ed is clearly going to reduce the cross-subsidy for many districts. I'll talk a little bit about the formula later and some of the aspects of the formula change that are a little bit murky at this point. We want to talk about that. The all-day K, I think, again, the all-day K, the movement toward all-day K, we've got a number of districts that are providing all-day K. This will help them. But again, as Mr. Kroonquist said, it would be great to go with Senator Claussen's bill or Senator Kent's bill that will get us up to the 1.0 and remove that kind of head-scratching that's going to go on the local level. Do we participate and get rid of fees, or do we continue to charge fees and not, increase the weighting? I think those are questions. And I think that's the problem when you go halfway down any road. You're putting local districts in this, question as to what do we do, because we're going halfway down the road. It'd be nice to have full commitments to less things as opposed to half commitments to many things. Teacher evaluation kind of falls into the same place. We really appreciate the teacher evaluation piece of $20 per pupil, but I represent a lot of districts, work with a lot of districts that haven't participated in QCOMP, and they haven't participated in QCOMP, frankly, because they haven't had the resources to locally put those QCOMP proposals together. We run in Schools for Equity Education relatively low revenue districts, below the state average, administratively light. And so when you're administratively light, it's difficult to put these QCOMP packages together. We hope that these centers of excellence can help with that. And I think that's another positive aspect of the governor's proposal. But clearly, I think the road that should be taken here is, making QCOMP available. And I see Senator Stumps here, and Senator Stumps talked about that much in the past, is to expand the QCOMP program and call it something else, call it teacher evaluation, which is what it's going to really morph into, and get districts that are not working on that or don't have QCOMP proposals and move them in that direction. I haven't been actually sunny up here, but I would say that, the ELL program, the going from 5 to 7 years, is also a very good thing. The integration revenue extension also is important. We have a number of districts that are working on the integration revenue. To talk about the integration revenue, though, again, Mr. Kroonquist and I work with several of the same districts and districts that are similar. Buffalo is a district that gets integration revenue, and people often scratch their head and say, Buffalo, why do they get integration revenue? Well, Buffalo's borders racially isolated Osseo, so they participate in the integration program. And I think that they've brought in students from the Osseo district. They've created a magnet school, an arts magnet school there. And the changes, as we look in the integration program, where Buffalo's not going to be losing money, for a district like Buffalo that is below the state average in terms of general education, that doesn't have a particularly high referendum, this integration revenue has helped create a program for a broad range of kids. And I think that we look at the integration revenue changes, and I think you'll see the same thing in Elk River and the same thing in Anoka Hennepin, that you're creating learning environments and you're using this revenue because you don't have access to higher levels of referendum that some districts do have. And so I think that again, the integration revenue is very, very important as we move forward to think about what it is being created and how can we preserve those opportunities. I think that, the equalization, I think the biggest disappointment for us in Schools for Equity Education, we understand that, Senator Scoy is going to be, has several bills on bringing back the general education levy, also doing increased equalization. I believe that There's some other bills that are coming in. Senator Hoffman has a bill that I think is the MSBA version of the equalization. We think that that absolutely needs to be discussed this year, and we think that's going to be discussed here, and that's going to be discussed in the Tax Committee. We think that there are many ways to get to that. I mean, Zen Buddhists say that there's 1,000 paths to the truth. I don't know if there's 1,000 paths to greater equal tax policy, but I think that there's a few, and I think that we'll look at those this year.
At least 67 paths.
At least 67 paths. You know, staying with Eastern religion, you know, equity is like the seven blind men and the elephant. I mean, it's like somebody's got the leg and someone's got the tail and someone's got the tusk, and equity looks different or feels different to many different people. I think the other thing that talk a little bit about the special ed formula change, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, and it's you know, feel free to saw it off if you'd like, but one of the things that's been problematic for, I think, me as an observer over the last 20 years and as someone who's lobbied and someone who's been on staff here in the late 1980s is the erosion of the general education formula in favor of categoricals. And I think that that is something that in Schools for Equity and Education, we put it on our website, we are districts for whom the basic formula is 87% of our general education revenue. The statewide average is 82%. So that basic formula, the balance between the basic formula and the categoricals is very, very important to us. Now, I'm not saying take money from anybody or just wholesale go in and rip out all the categoricals and put it all in the general ed formula. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the general education formula needs to be a more accurate reflection of what it costs to educate a child in Minnesota. If that keeps up with inflation, and if that's a sufficient amount, we see less pressure on local property taxpayers to pass referenda. And with the equalization, you know, there's for schools in equity and education, I guess this problem is that we're kind of chasing our own tail. The equalization is not keeping up, and the basic formula is not keeping up. So we have to go out and try to pass referenda that are unfair and have a disparate tax effect for us. And I think that I was hopeful that there would be more in this budget that would look at that particular issue. And I think that I'm a little bit, disappointed in that. The joke I've been using is that, you know, the folks, when they were working on the task force report or working group report, they loaded up the truck. But as a farm kid, you always got to tie stuff down. So when you're going down 35E from Roseville to the governor's mansion, a couple things fell out. And I think the thing is that we need to go back up 35E and find those things and get them back into the discussion. But I would say that generally, not to put too much gravitas here, because I think this is the beginning of the program, and we're going to discuss these things throughout the session. But again, as someone who's watched this over the last two decades, I think that in terms of complexity, in terms of the lack of kind of a real commitment to the basic formula, we're kind of at the verge of collapse in some sense. And we were hoping for some paradigm-shifting move, and I think the department started that with the working group, but we really still need to, embrace that this session. And I think that, count on me to, make bad jokes, but all hopefully also to provide some input as we move forward. But I think that we have some opportunities here. The governor has started us down this road. I urge you to all embrace that direction, accelerate it, and look at it in a more macro sense as some of the things that really do have to change in the education funding system. Thank you.
Mr. Lundell, and for your insights over the years and services, as well as the not just gloomy, you had a lot of entertainment in there too. So.
It's hard for Scandinavian this early in the morning.
questions, the committee. Okay, well, we'll certainly be revisiting.
Thank you.
And that's probably the key issue. So. Next, we'll hear from Jan Ermaseth, the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, and she'll be followed by Michael Garcia from the Duluth Children's Museum. And if there's anyone else wishing to testify, if you'd like to share that with staff. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Uyghur and members of the committee. As he stated, my name is Jan Armasa, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, known as MACE. I thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of our MACE members. As you know, the investment in education for students with disabilities is an economic investment in the skill development to have them be contributing members of our society. In the governor's package, there is a significant investment in dollars for special education for $125 million. MACE wholeheartedly thanks the governor for recognizing the importance of this education investment for our students with disabilities. We are in strong support of the $125 million investment, but we are trying to understand the implication of the new formula. As stated before, you know that this formula is a major change in reimbursement for staff members versus categorical areas for disability for autism, deaf and hard of hearing, special learning disabilities, and students with emotional and behavioral disorders. As stated before, it's imperative to address the cross-subsidies to the local school districts. MACE understands from MDE that in 2002, the cross-subsidy of the Education Foundation aid was 8.6%, and now MDE is forecasting that this will rise to 12.6% of the education aid. It is critical to address the fundamental underlying problem with the underfunding of special education at the federal and the state levels that, as you know, exponentially increased the responsibilities to the local school districts. MACE cannot have general education competing with special education. This is critical because it creates a moral dilemma and imperative between general ed and special ed. And as you see the looming sequester that is before us, that is to commence next month, March 1st, we know that that's going to be a 5% cut as well on the federal level, and that's a huge impact to our state. The other part is that the trends in special education are demonstrating that we're identifying students that are not just one disability category area, but are really multiple areas and with very complex issues. We also are serving students who need residential treatment, and they're in our schools on a daily basis. I say this by way of sharing with you that the directors are questioning what is the difference from the $194 million figure that was given to us from the Commissioner's Education Finance Working Group in their final recommendations. We're wondering what that means for the formula. We're willing to work with the governor and with MDE to understand the impact of the $70 million reduction. Does it mean a formula change? And if so, where is the change? The directors are struggling about the focus on the categories because, as you know, a student with autism, for example, doesn't just need a special education teacher. They also need a social worker who will help them with social skill development. They'll need a speech and language pathologist who's going to help them with language processing. They're going to need an occupational therapist who's going to help them with sensory integration and with creating environments that address issues with lights and noises. And they might also need a physical developmental PhysEd teacher who's going to help them with motor planning and execution. And how will all these professionals be included in the disability categories is a question to us in terms of understanding that. So the new special ed formula does include the pupil-driven formula that accounts for incident, and it also has costs related to the disabilities as well as the poverty concentrations and the excess cost formula, which, as you know, is also very important to us. It's our understanding that the new formula will have a growth factor, which will be critical and will be part of the sustainability and the predictability that we need in the structural changes. Another key component in the governor's package speaks to the issue of paperwork reduction. It is a $1.8 million online system. At this time, MACE understands that MDE will be designing an online system with model MDE forms. This would be a voluntary online system. And we observe that the vendor, so Mace has notes that MDE is saying that the vendors are the ones that are creating more forms that we have to fill out. This is not really how we see the dilemma. We see the dilemma really is the interpretation of the rules and the regulations that require extensive rewriting of the IEPs, the individual education plans, to have 20-page evaluation reports that have rewriting of the goals and objectives and of the prior written notices. And that is the dilemma that is actually creating the issue for our special educators. And as you know, we are facing a shortfall. We need to attract the best and highest quality persons into our field. And paperwork is a burden that they are perceiving and we are perceiving as a barrier to that. So we, Mace, thanks you for this opportunity to express our concerns before you. We seek your support in adequate funding, special education funding that is equitable, sustainable, and predictable. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Ormasa. Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ormasa, I hadn't considered the hit to our schools with the sequestration on the special ed, and so now that I am considering that, that is pretty concerning. Could you talk about how that might work in terms of, let's say, the sequestration happens on March 1st, which is looking likely, and yet then it gets fixed in some fashion at the end of March or something like that. How does the spigot go off and on that quickly, and how do school districts respond to that? And what is, I mean, then do they have to cash flow borrow, or what is the process for dealing with that?
Chair Reeder, yes, thank you, Senator Bonhoff. I think the issue, we have always wrestled with the federal commitment being at 40% and not funded. And it's noted that it's statewide, it's nationwide at 17%, but in some cases it's not even really 17%. So really the purpose of the federal dollars are really to help a lot with dealing with excess costs and the capacity to offer services that we need in areas. So if that starts closing down to us, then we're going to get more of that push, because I see the partnership between three parties, federal, state, and local. So if the federal decreases, then it's going to push on the local and the state again. And if the state doesn't do anything with the cross-subsidy, then the cross-subsidy continues to increase because we are a mandated service. So I'm very concerned about the impact of what's happening at the federal level, as well as the very tough decisions that I know your committee has to make with the decisions about how to allocate the education funding across all kids.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ormasa, I guess I'm still, though, just wanting to understand procedurally if that you had planned in, say, your district and you had planned for a certain amount of dollars, does that get booked like a receivable that's going to come one day, or does the cross-subsidy just automatically increase to cover the cash flow? Can you just share, do you know how?
Well, my experience in Hopkins has been, I served in Hopkins for 39 years as a director. Not as a director, but 39 years in the district. My experience is that it is booked as a receivable, but the issue is it impacts the general fund immediately, because we have to continue to serve the needs of the students according to the IEPs. So when the federal government doesn't keep their particular part, then we do end up having to figure out how that then impacts the following year with cuts. And okay. I have cut for over 14 years. Consecutively in special education. So we have a cumulative effect occurring as well.
Yeah. And members, on the sequestration issue, I asked the department last night if they could forward some information, and Mr. McHenry, with some help from staff, put together some information, because, you know, this is could be reality soon. And $23 million, excluding child nutrition, in our state, $8 million in Title I, $10 million in special ed, and then various breakdowns. I have a spreadsheet, and I think we'll distribute that for members to know, but it could happen. And was there a question? Yeah, Senator Hoffman, then.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Massa, since 94-142 went into law, I think the discussion of paperwork has been in. And a couple of questions on that. First, a statement. I'm glad that you reminded us that is a triadic relationship from the very beginning, the federal, state, and the local, that everybody has a piece. And as one shifts, it's going to shift over. So that was a good visualization of that. The paperwork reduction piece, I thought the last reauthorization and the one prior to that, the department was going to put together some best practice or put some model plans in place, model IEPs. I mean, what happened? Because we're still having the same conversation that we've had in 1973 regarding the paperwork. Can you help us understand where the breakdown happened on that?
Mr. Massa.
Chair Rieger, Senator Hoffman, I believe it has to do with the level of scrutiny of the rules and the regulations. When I started in 1972, an IEP was 3 pages. Now an IEP can be, as I said to you, a 20-page evaluation report, and it has to do with the level of skill acquisition that we've gotten over the years in terms of understanding differential diagnosis and the capacity for us to be able to analyze and understand our students' needs. But I think what's happening is it has to do with how, in the past, the department had positions that had practitioners in the field that were also peer monitors and were part of the compliance component. And now I believe it's fully staffed with attorneys. And so one of the components that we are experiencing, for example, is that it's in the writing of, a prior written notice. It's not only that you're saying that that you had a meeting and you discussed the child, and in that meeting you discussed all the options that were available to the family. You then have to document all of those options that were available to the family. You have to discuss the pro and con of each one of those options, and then you have to say what you're actually going to offer the student. And so if you think about that compared to over the course of time, I think the intent is to get better and better in terms of our profession and the quality of what we're trying to do. We want to be held accountable. But we also need the flexibility in terms of best practice and working towards student outcomes, which is really what we want. And we're not sure that compliance and student outcomes are lining up. And in fact, I think that's where the Office of Special Education at the federal level is really trying to move us towards results-oriented accountability, results-driven accountability. And so we're trying to learn how do we, with intent and purpose, be compliant without having the level of work that has to go into. I would tell you that all of our staff will serve the kids first and foremost, and so the paperwork is on their time. And that's where the burden starts to become part of the issue. Even though it may be built into their day with prep time, et cetera, it still doesn't accommodate.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Nino.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think when you hit the nail when you said the lawyers are now, and nothing against, you know, the attorneys, because this is a compliance issue. Special education services and due process rights go hand in hand. But please keep us posted as far as the merging of the best practice and the merging of the compliance piece, because if indeed we're setting regulations up that are hindering teachers from doing the work they're supposed to be doing, I think it's a system we need to take a look at, Chair, or have some ongoing discussions on that. So, and thank you. And one special ed teacher said one time to me, these kids are getting in the way of my paperwork. And she had a stack of transition stuff. And she jokingly said that. But you know what? It truly was an issue for her. So thank you.
Senator Nenow, followed by Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think mostly for the benefits of the members of this committee. And I know, Senator Bonoff, you had a conflict and weren't able to be there last night. Mr. Chair, you were there at the Finance Committee, but I just want to express some concerns that I vocalized last night with a bill that we have headed to the floor probably next week, I would anticipate, the healthcare exchange bill.
Would you like our committee to review that?
No, Mr. Chair, but I just want to give a heads up to the members because this committee here controls about 40% of the entire general fund.
And the bill that we have headed to the floor is going to put about a $135 million hole in the general fund, and it's not paid for. And this committee is not likely to be immune to the impact of that. So be aware of that particular concern, because that is something that we're going to have to deal with. And beyond that gets into the realm of more the Finance Committee. But I just want to make sure that this committee is aware of the challenges that we've got coming and that big hole that bill is going to create, at least in the Senate version. The other body's doing something different. So be aware of that, and make, if you haven't paid attention yet, you've probably seen it come through one of your committees or another, but they've changed it as it moved along. It's now de facto general fund money that's paying for that. It's no longer a tax on insurance premiums.
In the context of special ed, heads up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in the context of the sequestration and the additional challenges and all of that, we've got some issues coming at us, and we don't know what those are going to be until after March 1st, which, for the benefit of the members, I was trying to delay action on that bill until after March 1st, but the Finance Committee as a whole didn't see that as a wise move, although I did, obviously.
Thanks. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, I want to thank you for being one of the few committees not to review that bill. So I appreciate that.
I'm sure there'll be a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hormasa, I want to follow up on Senator Hoffman's question, taking a little bit more of a finance bent to it. How much of your time today or your teachers' times are spent in administrative compliance compared to several years ago when an IEP was maybe only 3 pages? And do you have any estimate of how much that's increasing the cost of delivering services because of lost time with students?
Ms. Smith?
Chair Rieger, Senator Pratt. Remember, it was 39 years ago that I did the 3-page IEP. So to put it into context, I think the real issue is that we want to be in compliance and we want to be held accountable. I think that all of my teachers and special ed related service providers would have said to you that the kids come first and that they would serve the kids. And so they would spend their day truly serving the kids. It's the paperwork burden has become a burden because it's the rewriting of the compliance. When a district is under compliance, it's the constant rewriting of that IEP that's becomes the burden to the paperwork when you're under such scrutiny. And so it's really about the interpretation of the rules and the regulations, not necessarily that the regulations are wrong or whatever, but really in that regard. So I don't know if I can specifically answer percentage of time, but I would say to you that they would say that an increasing percentage of their time is going towards paperwork if you looked at a 40-hour week or if you looked at a 60-hour week. Mm-hmm. You know that they're doing 60-hour weeks in order to be able to accommodate the paperwork that they need to get to serve their students and also to have the meetings. The relationships with families are huge. And for them, serving the student and spending time with families is really important in being able to understand if there's a difference of opinions between family, that they're spending time understanding that so that they can come to some kind of agreement of the service delivery.
Hey, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Ms. Hormasa. I've got to believe and I've seen that there's an opportunity cost to the increased compliance procedures that are in place, not drawing any sort of opinion on the regulation itself. But one more quick question. Does MACE have a position on the 10% responsibility of the serving district on delivering services?
Mr. Marasso?
Chair Rieger, Senator Pratt, yes, MACE does have an opinion about the 90-10. As you know, we are serving districts and providing districts. So when a student open enrolls to another district, there is concern sometimes that there isn't as much attention paid to cost containment as there would be if that student was served within our own district. So the 10% is really sort of, excuse this colloquialism, but having some skin in the game, so to speak, in terms of also feeling some accountability for the costs about providing services to our student in another district. So we do appreciate the 90-10 formulation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Mr. Morrison.
Thank you for this opportunity, and I thank the committee because you have a very complex issue before you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Mike Garcia from the Duluth Children's Museum. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you so much for adding me to the agenda. My name is Michael Garcia. I'm president and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. I've driven 35 many times, and I can assure one of the previous testifiers that there was nothing that dropped off the cart along Highway 35. I would have stopped and picked up those additional resources had I seen them. But joking aside, I actually did make the trip down yesterday. I was monitoring a House committee hearing, and I drove back to Duluth last night because we were having a discussion in our community about sequestration and the federal budget and what impact it was going to have on community service organizations like my own. And after doing that, looking at your committee hearings and the rest of today, I decided that it was important to be here. Having not signed up, we do have a small provision in the governor's bill for the Duluth Children's Museum under an appropriation through the Department of Education. This funding has been provided to the Duluth Children's Museum each of the last 6 years under the state budget. And what I want to speak to today is just the importance of the investment in early childhood and in informal education partners in the state of Minnesota. The Duluth Children's Museum was established in 1930 as the fifth oldest children's museum in the nation. Not everybody in the state realizes that we have that treasure in the state. And unlike the emergence of modern children's museums across the country, the Duluth Children's Museum is somewhat unique. Brooklyn, Indianapolis, Chicago are the other four that came before us, and we have a collection-based artifact collection of over 50,000 historic objects that we use in the integration between that and hands-on learning with our children in Duluth. We have extensive community partnerships, and that is what's pressing on us most as we look at the federal budget and the impact of the potential loss of funding in a week that affect programs like ECFE and Head Start Transitional Housing. The Children's Museum is an organization that has become a resource for the entire region of northeastern Minnesota. When I say that, we have now over 12,000 individual members, and I tell those children, I don't have children and I don't have grandchildren, so my door is open. If I am in my office, you are welcome to come in and tell me what it is that we need to be doing that affects your life and what difference we make in your life. And those children do find their way to my door, and they come from Pine City to International Falls, from Aiken to Grand Marais, and they use the Children's Museum as a source for informal learning and for fun. It's not only that, it is the importance of providing an environment where learning can occur when a family is in crisis. Last night, when I got back, the museum was still open, and I went into my office, and there were six children with two of their parents, two parents out of the four parents that I knew, on the second floor of the museum outside my office. And the children were subdued but were playing in the museum. And I looked at one of the young men, and I said to him, "Is there something wrong?" And he said, "You haven't heard yet." And I said, "No, why don't you step into my office?" And I invited him into my office, and I looked at him, and he began to cry. And he said, "We are here today because their parents are planning their uncle's funeral for the children. He committed suicide last night. And we asked the children, while the rest of the family went to make arrangements, where they wanted to go, and they said they wanted to go to the Children's Museum." I bring that up because it's only one example. It's a difficult one, but it is a true one, of the people in crisis that find their pathway and find the door to the Children's Museum. We work with the Head Start program that works with transitional housing. Transitional housing provides services to homeless children in Duluth. Over 330 of the children who walk through the doors of the Duluth school system every day come from homeless settings. There was no informal partner in the community of Duluth that provided a home for these adult parents and their children to hold their parent education meetings. And so the Duluth Children's Museum is now that provider. And those parents meet there every other week, and their children have free admission to the museum while they participate in educational programs, and their parents get the resources that help them manage out of transition, hopefully into more stable living environments. We work with the Boys and Girls Club. We work with the Robotics Club for the Duluth. We work with what's called the NISNET, the Nanoscale Informal Science Education Network. We're now working with NASA and with NOAA in the city of Duluth. The investment that the state of Minnesota is making in this program is $50,000 annually. The Christmas morning metaphor was a funny one, and it resonated well with me because I was born on the 26th of December, and I always think on my birthday, gee, I would have liked to have gotten a little more. So perhaps it's more the Oliver Twist metaphor that I would use in saying, if we had more in our bucket, we would use it well. But that said, I realize that what you do, and I've worked in education reform for the last 45 years in education finance on a variety of agendas, what you do is some of the most serious work done at our state legislature. On behalf of the 12,000 children that I represent as members and the additional 75,000 that visit the museum, I want to thank you for the hard work. I want to encourage you to keep that placeholder in the budget as represented by the governor, and would welcome any questions at all.
Oh, Mr. Garcia, thank you so much for returning back your compassion for sharing the story of not only those 12,000 children, their families and grandparents and others in the community. We sincerely appreciate your sharing a $50,000 appropriation in this huge budget for each year and all the good that it's doing. Any questions from the committee? Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee.
Members, next, and we have, I believe, two more testifiers. Then we're going to ask Mr. McHenry from the department to comment. I think he had about 10 or 15 additional minutes, and he will also have that opportunity to comment on some of the advice that's been given, perhaps. And then I'll give announcements regarding tomorrow and a little shift in plans where we'll still meet, but then we're going to set up a couple of separate meetings with the respective caucus groups to talk about what we have and where we're at and where we're going. So next testifier is Ron Solberg from Superior Public Schools, Lake Superior, along the shore. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have a handle that's going around that kind of gives you an indication that we have a nice little map there of the school districts that comprise this organization. Yes. Basically all the way from Grand Marais and Grand Portage on down to
Mr. Solberg, for the tape, please state your name.
I'm sorry, Ron Solberg with Lake Superior Area Schools. I hadn't planned on testifying this morning, so you're lucky. I'll be even briefer than normal. But I just thought, since there is that opportunity, I get that handed out and mention a couple of things today. Unlike Brad Lundell, our organization is very appreciative of what the governor has done. We understand just how difficult it is to come up with the revenues to try to provide additional funding for school districts. I'm not really picking on Brad. But I just had to say that this is after years of struggling, it's good to see the momentum start to rise again as far as some funding for school districts, and we recognize the difficulty in doing that, although our school districts probably wouldn't come in anywhere near the top of the groups as far as funding that's being recommended in the governor's group, we do appreciate the increases, and we've been hopeful to get to see those increases for quite a while, and hope as the economy continues to improve and state legislature continues to make that commitment that that we can continue that funding. One of the common themes we have within our school districts is the fact that until this last year, almost none of our school districts were able to pass a referendum. A lot of them didn't even try because we're such low valuation districts. And we're hopeful that that more can be done along those lines in terms of that kind of equalization that's needed for school districts that just don't have those additional sources of revenue. I guess I probably should clarify that these school districts are from northeastern Minnesota, but except for Cook County and for the Lake Superior School District, none of them belong to RAMS, the Range Association. So we're the other districts in northeastern Minnesota, and that's, I think, this group formed itself probably about 15 or 20 years ago, and I worked for the Duluth School District, who I still represent, but I started representing them as well as our area school districts and a group of our area superintendents group to help represent them as well. The other portion of the low valuation is the fact that our school districts have also had a great deal of difficulty in trying to keep up with facilities maintenance, and the facilities and the equipment that are needed to adequately prepare a school to provide that education. And we're glad to see Senator Stumpf here. We're very hopeful that he'll take almost his entire bonding bill and apply it to school districts that have had floods and school districts that haven't been able to afford to provide the equalization to sell the bonds to be able to fix those school districts up. And I'm very hopeful that that'll occur, Senator Stumpf. No, but we, in all seriousness, this is another issue that we're looking at, and if there's any possibility of any state funding, either through bonding or through greater equalization, we certainly would appreciate it. I'll stop there. I could go on a number of issues. Many of them are similar to the issues that other school districts face. However, I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Solberg. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I had one question in your handout. Can you talk to me or to us about adjusting the school formula should be adjusted by a transition revenue component? Can you tell me what your request is?
Mr. Solberg.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. It's a good thing that you asked that question so I can clarify that. What I meant there was if we're not able to achieve a new formula that is a more simplified and a better funded formula than the one that we currently have without additional funding, rather than having the funding redistributed between school districts and some districts actually coming out losers as we attempt to improve the school finance formula, that we would hope, and there is something in the governor's bill, this was done quite a bit before the governor's bill came out, that would provide that kind of hold harmless, I think is another expression that's used besides the transition funding to do that with. I was thinking of as I was listening to Mr. Lundell, we've had a number of different groups, PS Minnesota, the current equalization, the current school finance study group, and before that, before the alliance was formed, there was another group a number of years ago that put together people from all over the states and organizations from all over the states to come up with a simplified formula that met school districts' needs across the state. And we brought, very proudly, came to a conclusion and brought the conclusion to Senator Roger Moe. And he took a while and looked at it, and he said, you know, it's not hard to figure out that you could all agree that you need $6 billion more. And that's, of course, always the issue in order to meet the needs of individual needs of all districts. It can be expensive. So we're doing this with baby steps, and we understand that. So we're just hopeful that we don't start taking money from each other in order to come up with a new formula.
Thank you very much, Mr. Solberg.
Thank you.
Our next testifier, Mary Gilbert, St. Paul Schools. Welcome.
Welcome and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert, the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools, and I would just like to thank the governor for making a serious investment in K-12 education. Our district did have a representative on the school finance task force, and she did support the recommendations that were forwarded, and we were happy to see that many of them from the task force were included in the governor's budget recommendations. Particularly, we are pleased with the investment in pre-K and all-day K. As I've said before, we have 750 students on our four-year-old kindergarten waiting list, and about 1,300 of our kids come to kindergarten without any pre-kindergarten experience at all. And so we're glad to see that we'll be able to serve more students under that. We're also
Ms. Gilbert, could you state how many students are on a waiting list?
We have 750 four-year-olds currently on our waiting list for our four-year-old program. And about 70% of them are free reduced lunch, ELL, or special ed. So it's the target population that demonstrates the biggest impact for investment in pre-K education. We are also supporting the changes to the special ed. We have a large special ed cross-subsidy for both special education and English language learners. We spend about $12 million from our general fund just for our ELL population. I think that'll be actually even more important for other districts that are serving ELL going from 5 to 7 years, because kindergarten, even if it's a half-day kindergarten, counts as a full year of service for an ELL student. And so, again, that'll be even more critical. We're providing all-day K with our referendum in St. Paul, but this will actually be more helpful, I think, to other districts. We are also supportive of the changes, both the language and the support of the integration proposal that's in place. We applaud the fact that there's going to be the ability to set up a program or in place that's best suited for the community with a lot of public input. We do urge the committee, though, to consider continuing the integration levy. That is critical, really, I think, to every district. Again, it's not just a St. Paul issue. The levy is important to all the districts that are currently in the integration program, and we hope that that issue is addressed. We did levy for it last fall, so for our district, it's not really going to be a property tax increase. It's going to be something that we've been doing, you know, since the program was started. If I had one wish, since people are putting in their wish list, it would have been nice to restore some kind of general education levy. All of us testified during the Ventura administration that getting rid of the general education levy would be a mistake, that it provided a good source of revenue, that it provided some stability, especially in the event of an economic downturn, which we've all seen happen, unfortunately. It happened. And so if there was some way, and I know that the governor's office and the commissioner is looking at that as well, we're kind of at the lowest point of property values in the state. So to be able to kind of ride that back up, it would be good, because you actually don't even have to change the tax rate if you see property values growing across the state. It's kind of a beautiful thing, and it's kind of a good opportunity to do it right now. And if there was any way to figure that out, either now or within the next year or two, I think we could take advantage of the state kind of coming back from the recession and also not having it be a huge impact on taxpayers if it's done in a way that's fair to all communities. Since you mentioned sequestration, it's a particular concern to us. As a district with high poverty, it's going to directly affect Title I and special education, and that's like the biggest group that we serve under the federal money. And I know that we've done some calculations. I think we've all been kind of hoping it wasn't going to happen, but as the deadline approaches, I think our fear is growing, and I'll be able to get that information to the committee.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert, questions? Thank you. Next, Kevin McHenry from the Department of Education. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin McHenry from the Department of Education. And I know you're asking advocates to come in, and I will say from the department's perspective, we are really pleased with the bill that was brought forward from the governor. Mr. Lundell talked about the truck on 35 missing some pieces. I do travel that route quite a bit, as MDE is in Roseville, and coming to the Capitol. And I will say the work of the task force was a significant amount of work that was really broad-based and covered a wide range of areas. And so I think what's important is that there were several pieces from that task force included in the governor's recommendations. Obviously, not all pieces were included in there, but we look forward to continuing the conversation on that. I know the governor was put in a tough spot because the truck coming from the Education Finance Task Force was not the only truck, and several tough decisions do have to be made in putting together a budget. So just a few things I just wanted to comment is what we've stated before is when this bill was put forward, we realized that MDE nor the governor's office has the monopoly on all great ideas. We know that there are organizations, all of you at the table here, those in the House and other legislators that are willing to bring good ideas forward, and we want to be able to listen and work with you all moving forward to put together the best possible education funding bill that we can. But a few things I did want to point out just to clarify. It was stated earlier on the teacher evaluation that that there were no requirements for charter schools once they received their to receive the funds. I did want to indicate that there is a provision in the bill for charter schools to have a teacher evaluation program in place. It may not be the exact same thing in place as traditional districts, but that is that is something that is included in the bill. We realize that the $10 million included in the teacher evaluation is about $22 per student. It may not cover the entire cost, or it probably doesn't cover the entire cost of implementing the teacher evaluation program, but we feel it is a good start in the right direction, and we look forward to working with you on that. As you've heard from all the different groups coming up, one of the difficult things in putting together an education bill is that there are several different interests competing for what they view as the most important piece moving forward in this bill. And so what we try to do is get a broad range that's something that's helpful for the entire state, that helps all kids, all schools, and all teachers. So just to go through a few things. Overall, there's in this bill, it's $344 million new dollars for education. In the first year, in FY14, that amounts to about a $72 per pupil increase. In the second year, with some of the reforms including it in the special ed portion, it's about a $339 per student increase, and that's on average. Obviously, you know, as we're working through the as things go through the formula, it isn't exact for every specific district, but that's just on average. Under the $344 million, $125 million of that is for the special education changes in the formula. We are really excited to bring this forward, and we know that there's been some discussion here today and in the past on what these changes might do. We encourage you all to take a deep look into this. If you want to have a further hearing, we're more than happy to come in and specifically talk just about the special ed formula. We think it's really good that it does link to actual costs per student, and it does have some so it drives some efficiencies there. The 10% set aside that was questioned before, and we appreciate that being brought up. I think one of the ideas was that by having, for lack of a better term, some skin in the game, that can provide for the providers to make sure that they deliver services in a more cost-effective manner. It may not be perfect, but it's a step in the right direction. And on average, that special ed increase will reduce the cross-subsidy of about $180 per pupil across the state. There was the formulaic increase in the first year of $118 million. One of the things we're really excited about, and actually a colleague of mine that I work with in the Office of Early Learning, our Director of Early Learning, is Karen Cadigan. We were here this morning working with some of your colleagues on the issue of early education. And we're really excited for the $44 million that's included in early childhood scholarships. That's going to expand the early childhood scholarship program, or opportunities, I should say, to cover about 15% of the needed population. We know there's a lot of work to do. We're working, our director, Cadigan, is working really closely with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health across agency to make sure that this program and this new initiative works in the best manner possible. So I'd applaud her efforts and the efforts across agencies on this. There is the expansion in all-day K. We appreciate the comments that were brought forward of funding that even more. We felt that this was a step in the right direction to help incent districts to have more students participate in all-day K. We think that it'll increase the participation to about 85%, but we're definitely open to talking about more if you'd like. I did touch on the teacher evaluation. Again, that's about $22 per pupil. That is directed to districts that aren't participating in QComp. I think the rationale behind that is that the QComp districts are getting a significant amount of money for their teacher preparation programs. Part of what is included under the law for teacher evaluation is dealing with teacher preparation, evaluation, and training. And so we thought that would be helpful as a start in the right direction and look forward to continuing that conversation. On the regional centers was another initiative. One of the things we're really excited on this, we talked about it briefly, but one of the things that's happening right now is that under our NCLB waiver, we do have three regional centers of excellence. However, right now they worked specifically with just Title I schools that are labeled as priority and focus schools. Those schools are the lower performing schools in the state and the state that contributes to the most to the achievement gap. By expanding our regional centers across the state, we think it's a great way to share best practices. We think it's a great way for regions to work together. And it's also a way that all schools can participate in sharing good ideas. There were some comments in relation to the paperwork reduction for special education. One thing we'd like to say on this is this has been an initiative of the commissioner and the governor since they started, was to provide more of a support-based system in special education rather than a compliance-based system. One of the things we worked on this interim was a reduction of the total special education system, which is basically a report. It's several hundred pages. Our director in special education and our director in monitoring worked on reducing that for districts to about 12 pages through some electronic forms and through some consolidation. The next step, what we'd like to do in this bill, was working on these IEP paperwork for districts. What this bill would do is it would provide model paperwork that districts could use. So it could be electronic forms with drop-down menus that could be easy to use. It would be aligned specifically to the federal requirements for special education. I think one of the things you hear right now is that districts have been telling us is that, you know, we don't want the state to go beyond what the federal requirements are. One of the testifiers did say part of our response has been that vendors sometimes do allow or provide some more options for districts on their paperwork. What this plan would do is align it specifically to federal regulations. It would be optional for districts to use, and it would be also free for districts to use. So some smaller districts that may not have the special education staff to put together this paperwork, it will helpfully alleviate some of the work that they do. And if a district chooses to continue with the vendor or use a different provider, they are more than welcome to do that. This is just an option that we're hoping to provide for them. We also have the Climate Center was raised. Obviously, we want to provide a safe environment for students going into school. I think the Climate Center is something that that will be working cross-agency to provide some best practices and some evidence-based research on what schools can do and hopefully provide some training with schools. We know that as schools are working to provide safe environments and some legislation that can come out as far as what they are required to do or what they may have to do, we want to be as supportive as possible so they can accomplish those goals. And finally, the expansion that was mentioned from the English learners from 5 to 7 years. We hope to continue this conversation. We spoke to the policy committee on this. I think one of the ideas behind the expansion from 5 to 7 years is that immigrants are immigrating to Minnesota, there are several challenges that they are facing. Sometimes they don't have a full grasp of their native language, and that can cause some problems as they're learning English. Many times they're highly mobile, which if a student speaks English perfectly, they have trouble as they're moving school districts constantly. And so we think that this is an initiative that will be helpful for students to succeed, specifically so they can learn English. So with that, I think I've hopefully addressed some of the concerns. Well, I just want to say we really look forward to continue working on this. And as you can see, what we're trying to do is provide some flexibility for districts. We want to make sure that districts are held accountable, but they're able to define what it is they need to do to reach those accountability measures. And as we're trying to provide some of that flexibility, there's obviously some pushback as you have the debate between should we have specific categoricals or should we have more flexibility. And we're willing to have that debate and we're willing to have that discussion. We think that's a great discussion for you all to have here in this committee. So with that, just closing up, if there's any questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Mr. McHenry, thank you. Questions of the committee? Okay, we'll be hearing more. So thank you. And I reiterate Mr. McHenry and the department's willingness to respond for any questions, suggestions on items that you've raised in questions for follow-up. So please do that, and because I know they're waiting and are working on a couple of particular areas that we have called out already. Thank you, Mr. McHenry.
Thank you.
Members, tomorrow we have another meeting scheduled at 8:30. We have a few persons that are signed up to testify, and I thought we'd go until 9:30, so if you can please be here as close to 8:30 as you can. And for others that want to testify at a future point, we'll fit you in. But I thought it'd be a good time after 9:30 just to set up some meetings with various members just to talk informally, no actions taken, but just amongst yourselves, start reflecting further on where we're at, what you're hearing from your district, how particular items that you like. I think we have emerging consensus on a number of items that have been mentioned, and obviously there's been some red flags that have been pointed out. So we want to just talk a bit more about that, and I'll send out an email to you soon, but keep your schedule free to the extent you can until 11 o'clock tomorrow, and you'll get an email with more information regarding that. And then that'll help set the stage for future meetings. Though I'll let you know, everyone that's requested a hearing, we've heard the bill. And for next week, we have two bills, and I believe they've been posted. We'll hear from Senator Scoy, Senate File 120, Red Lake Capital Investment. It'd be a bonding proposal, but they'll ask for suggestions. And Senator Lori, Senate File 297, has a bill regarding Moose Lake and Rushford Peterson. Yes, and so we'll, and if there's other bills that you have and you haven't put in a request, that has to be done. And we're all aware of the deadlines, which get closer each day. So for Wednesday of next week, there are a few bills that we're still waiting for the processing, but let me know again if that's something that we can hopefully accommodate. Thursday, the budget forecast, and that will be in this room, so we won't be meeting, but we obviously will be tuned in to those results, and over the next few weeks, obviously, then that will be setting the stage for the amount of revenue that we'll be looking at and how that's all allocated. So overall, that's the big picture as I see it. Are there any questions or comments on where we're at this point? Okay. On behalf of the testifiers and particularly Mr. Garcia, thank you again for driving back from Duluth last night and sharing your story. And for the other testifiers, thank you. And if you cite anything on 35E that's fallen off the truck, a little reward off.
Members, we're adjourned.